Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. YouTube cat videos, endless Facebook feeds, Netflix binges, all sources of pleasure, but in truth, also major wastes of time. But the fact is that we do look for ways to waste that time. In other words, we procrastinate. Is it avoidance, laziness, or the thrill of the deadline looming over your head? But what if procrastination, done right, might be something else entirely? What if it might be just the thing that your brain needs in order to flower into brilliance? This hour on Point, how great minds in history found innovation through procrastination. You can join us on air or online. Are you a procrastinator? Do you hate yourself for it? Or do you find that you need that time, those distractions, in order to be creative? Don't dally. Do pick up the phone now and call. Or you can join us anytime, even later at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today from New York is Andrew Santella. He's a Brooklyn-based writer for GQ and the New York Times Book Review. His new book is Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. We've got an excerpt at it at onpointradio.org. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you. Okay, so before we actually dive into what you've written in your book, I just want to get something out of the way because I, too, have been doing this all day. So On Point listeners, on the website, when we asked you for your thoughts about procrastination, here's what you did. Meh, I'll check it out later. One of my New Year's resolutions is to stop procrastinating starting next year. I can't post a thoughtful comment right now, maybe later. Some of my best ideas are yet to come. So very, very droll, guys. Got it. I've been doing the same thing all day. So we got that out of the way. Andrew, let's talk about your book here, because it's a really interesting notion to sort of turn procrastination on its head and find it as a source for inspiration. What got you started thinking about this?
Well, I was looking for ways to excuse my habit and to rationalize and justify my habit. I thought that if I, you know, dug down deep enough into the history, into the philosophy, into the psychology of the thing, of procrastination, I might find some rationalization. I'm not sure I ever found what I was looking for, but I found a lot of things that I wasn't looking for that ended up being, you know, pretty worthwhile. And I think that's appropriate for the topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us some let's dive into some of the stories that you've got here, because they really are eye opening and made me see several of the world's great minds in quite a different way. You start by asking and telling the story about Charles Darwin and why, what, two decades went by between his first major observations about evolution and between that time and when he finally got around to publishing On the Origin of Species. So tell us this story. Why did it take him so long?
I love Darwin's story, and I came to really love Darwin too, or at least, you know, my sense of him. Because, you know, despite his uncontestable brilliance and genius, he's a lot like us. And it's his ambivalence and his delay that I think makes him like us and makes us able to understand him a bit and relate to him. Anyway, so the thing is that he took those decades to develop his idea, and that's understandable. A scientist has to be diligent and check his work and do the work. But it would seem that Darwin's delay went beyond that, and that there might have been something else operating, some reluctance to tackle a topic or some ambivalence about the topic. While he might have been working on his big idea, as you mentioned, he became obsessed with barnacles.
Well, yeah. So tell me more about that, because 1838, he first writes down in one of his little notebooks that each species changes. So that's like our entree into his amazing observations. But then he sort of like steps away from that and becomes obsessed with barnacles.
They were all over the Darwin house, apparently, in pickled in jars and in his study and everywhere. The story is that one of his children was so used to there being barnacles everywhere that he thought everyone lived like that. And when the kid went to visit a friend at the friend's house once, he was surprised not to see barnacles. Where does your father do his barnacles, he wanted to know.
Why doesn't your father have a custom-made barnacle microscope?
And it wasn't just the barnacles. I mean, Darwin was fascinated with earthworms and did a great deal of study on earthworms in his backyard, which he selected partially. He bought the house and the property partly because he really liked the soil. I mean, you know, it's funny because most of us, maybe like the number of bathrooms would be important or something like that. The calciferous soil is what sold Darwin on the place, apparently. Huh. But he got obsessed with earthworms and he edited a gardening magazine. He was doing all sorts of things other than writing up his big idea.
Right. So this is the thing. And it's why Darwin's example, I find it to be so fascinating, right? Because he's not watching YouTube cat videos or the, 19th century equivalent thereof. I don't even know what the equivalent would be. But he's fantastically busy, like you said, editing those magazines, producing volumes on coral reefs and volcanic islands, studying those barnacles, et cetera. So he was productive in other areas. But we're calling this procrastination. Why?
Well, I think that's one of the hallmarks of procrastination. People make the mistake of thinking that procrastination is synonymous with laziness. And in fact, procrastinators are often the busiest people you know. It's just they're busy doing things other than the things they're supposed to be doing. And it really has nothing to do with laziness. I mean, to put off one thing often involves doing something else. And the thing that I ran up against again and again in my research was that the second sort of unsanctioned thing that you do instead of the, main thing that you're supposed to do, sometimes that second thing ends up being more worthwhile and more wonderful than the first.
Mm. Well, but he even, as you write, he later reflects back on his barnacle time and says... Go ahead.
As you said, he wasn't sure that he should have taken all that time on the barnacles. He was ambivalent about it. But it's also clear that he learned things from the barnacles and from the earthworms that informed his big idea. He learned things about small incremental changes that lead to large consequences. This was a huge idea for Darwin, and it's sort of at the heart of natural selection. And his work, sort of as misplaced, maybe as it might seem to us, on barnacles and on earthworms, all that work informed his big idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's where you're getting at to the part where about Darwin's story, which I feel like maybe we can start drawing some lessons for our own lives. Not all of us are going to come up with ideas that utterly transform science, but to your point about he had the germ of an earth-shattering idea, and maybe not the data or the research yet fully fleshed to publish his book, but he did all these other things in the period of two decades, other forms of research, exploration, etc., which informed his work, bought him the time to have the confidence in his original idea, right? Because look, evolution was. The concept was wildly controversial, to say the least, and perhaps it hasn't lost its controversy in this day and age. I'm rambling here. I'm not procrastinating. I'm just trying to make a point that in Darwin's case, in his own way, he bought himself the time such that the full flower of On the Origin of Species could come to pass, that he couldn't have written this book when he first wrote down that little observation in his notebook.
That's all exactly right, except he sometimes felt that he'd waited too long. In fact, he was sounded panicked at times.
Uh-huh.
He was eventually prodded into getting on the Origin of Species out because he learned that another naturalist was working along the same lines and was developing the same ideas. He'd shared his ideas with only a few select friends, and some of those friends had been urging him to publish, and he hadn't. And when he learned that the other naturalist was on the verge of publishing, Darwin wrote his friend that you've been right all along. I've waited too long. It's come back. It's come back to bite me. And well, those might not have been the exact words, but along those lines, I'm paraphrasing. Yeah, so Darwin sort of he and his friends had to arrange sort of a rushed publication before the publication, a rushed sort of joint presentation of the ideas behind natural selection to the scientific community.
Right.
It was only the specter of losing, you know, the scientific priority, you know, being first to the idea that finally drove Darwin to end the delay and to publish.
Okay, so maybe I should put a little finer point on it. I mean, does Darwin's story tell us that there is a purpose to procrastination?
Well, I think it tells us that it's a really human universal impulse, and that you find it not only in bunglers and bumblers, but also in people of genius. And it's one of the stories that sort of made me feel just a little bit better about my procrastination habit, not feel quite so guilty about it. And it made me sort of understand that that there might be some value to procrastination.
Uh-huh.
Although maybe not exactly the value that one might think.
Oh, interesting. So we'll explore that when we come back. I'm speaking with Andrew Santella. He is a Brooklyn-based writer for publications such as GQ and the New York Times Book Review. His book is called Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. We've got an excerpt at it at our website, onpointradio.org. Really interesting story about Charles Darwin. We'll get to more, including Da Vinci and Frank Lloyd Wright, when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about why we procrastinate and whether or not some procrastination can actually lead to innovation. I'm joined today by Andrew Santella. He's author of the new book, Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. And we'd love to hear your stories about procrastination and whether it was a good or a bad thing. Why do you think there are times where we look for ways to put off the inevitable? Follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, the issue of procrastination is one that's sort of good for comedic gold. And I just want to play a couple of clips here to that end. This is Ellen DeGeneres in 2014. She loves to talk about how much she's a procrastinator. Again, this is 2014 on Ellen.
Researchers at the University of Colorado have discovered a procrastination gene. Apparently, if you look at it under the microscope, it's the only gene that's watching cat videos on YouTube. And the other genes are like, come on, let's do stuff. And they're like, wait.
Procrastination gene, maybe not. All right, this is from The Simpsons.
Someday, these kids will be out of the house, and you'll regret not spending more time with them.
That's a problem for future Homer. Man, I don't envy that guy.
God. Future Homer. All right, Andrew Santella. Is that part of the problem here, that we're constantly thinking about our future selves, or maybe not thinking enough about our future selves, and that's one of the major drivers of procrastination?
Yeah, I think procrastination is sort of an illustration of our tendency to value the short-term reward and the present over long-term rewards, maybe larger rewards that we have to wait for. Behavioral economists are really interested in that idea.
Yeah. Well, look, we have a doubter here who sent us a comment on our website. Jim is writing, I absolutely do not believe any link in procrastination with these geniuses. Da Vinci and Darwin were beyond their times, and their work manifests itself. Look, procrastination is laziness, Jim writes in all caps, and nothing else. So respond to that, and maybe we ought to hear your story about why you count Da Vinci as one of your subjects for this book.
Well, I would agree with some of what Jim said. I think that to say that procrastination leads to innovation is a somewhat more optimistic take on it than I would make. I do think there's some value to thinking about why we procrastinate, and I do think that we can learn a lot about ourselves by sort of attending to our procrastination, listening to it, if I could use the jargon, and you know, trying to understand it. To answer your question about Leonardo, he's a guy who his contemporaries thought of as – well, some of his contemporaries thought of him as a hopeless bungler. Which is, you know, because we think of him as this great man of science, engineer, artist, the ultimate Renaissance man. But his contemporaries, Michelangelo, loved to needle him about how he never finished his projects. I think it was Pope Leo X, maybe Pope Leo IX. I get my Pope Leo's mixed
confused.
Up.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But he said nothing will ever come of this man. They thought that that he was a bumbler and had no discipline. The thing about him, though, was his genius and his mind was so polymathic, and he was pulled in so many different directions at once.
Yeah.
So that instead of just attending to the portrait that one of his rich patrons wanted him to paint, he might instead get locked onto some, wonderful machine that he was thinking up, or some anatomical sketch or something. I mean, there were always something else that was catching his attention and his genius.
Mm-hmm.
So we could call that procrastination, or we could just call that a mind that is overflowing with ideas.
Yeah. Well, so we've got a lot of listeners who want to share their stories of procrastination. I'm talking to Andrew Santella. He's author of Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. Josh is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Josh.
Yes. Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking my call. It's funny. I think this is a great topic because as I'm calling you, I'm here lying in bed with my girlfriend, and it's already 11:30. Granted, it's a snow day, but we have a lot to do today. And we're just kind of watching videos, listening to your show. And I think it's interesting because both of us but both of us have ADD, and I think that is kind of a hallmark trait of ADD, kind of trouble getting things started.
Uh-huh.
So I'd kind of be interested to hear what your guest has to say about that. And also, I do find that procrastinating can help me both because if I have a deadline, the closer I am to that deadline without having done anything, the more I get into a panic, and that panic kind of propels me to finally get stuff done. I need to be in that panic mode.
Josh, thank you so much for your call. I hope you're enjoying your snow day. Andrew Santelli, Josh is bringing up a couple really interesting questions. I mean, because much of your book has to do with how psychology through the ages has tried to tackle this problem of procrastination. But to Josh's point about ADHD, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, there are people, as much as I like to have fun with the topic, and there are people for whom it's a serious problem, that, you know, because of their depression or because of their anxiety or because of their attention disorder. And it's a one way to think about procrastination so that it may not just be putting something off. It could also so some researchers talk about it as a disorder of the executive function.
Yeah,
the part of the brain that regulates our daily discipline.
Uh-huh.
Well, so if that's the case, maybe what we call procrastination is just a executive function disorder.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I just want to jump in there because this is a great time to bring in our next guest who has a lot to say about sort of the functioning of the brain. Tim Urban joins us. His 2016 TED Talk is called Inside the Mind of a Master Procrastinator. It was one of the most viewed talks of the year, and he writes about everything from Elon Musk to artificial intelligence on his hugely popular blog. It's called Wait, But Why. Tim Urban, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Okay, so you've been hearing Andrew and I talk about sort of these different examples of great procrastinators through time. And I was interested when Andrew was just talking about sort of executive function and what that has to do with procrastination. But you built a whole model around why people procrastinate. So walk us through your model.
Yeah, I always say I'm not an expert on things I write about, but this is a topic where I'm an expert on what it feels like to be a procrastinator, even if I definitely am not an expert on finding the solution to it. I think that what goes on in my head is that there's three characters in there, actually. There's kind of the adult who's my age. I'm 36 and so is this guy. He's the rational decision maker. And he just wants to do whatever makes sense. So it's not that he never wants to have fun. There's plenty of times it makes sense to have fun or to do something leisurely. He just wants to do those things when it makes sense to, and he wants to work when it makes sense to, and work on things that would be most rational at that time.
Yeah.
The problem is he's not in there alone. He's got some haunting, twisted ghost of some 7-year-old that I used to be, that I call the instant gratification monkey. So this is a character that lives only in the present moment, doesn't have any kind of knowledge of the future, doesn't learn any lessons from the past, and just wants to maximize the ease and pleasure of the current moment just all the time. And they're in a constant kind of power struggle. And yeah. I think everyone's got this power struggle. And the thing that makes someone
I was just
going to
say, it sounds so familiar to me. Yeah.
Well, it's not that only procrastinators have this monkey. It's that in the heads of procrastinators, the monkey wins the battle. That's the thing. It's who's the alpha character in the brain. Can this adult say not now like they would to a child? Or Does the monkey just grab the wheel and the rational decision maker is kind of helpless in those moments?
So why does the monkey win the battle so often? I mean, there's something fundamental about how we view the future value of things that makes that immediate gratification monkey so very powerful.
I think that he really doesn't understand that future you is him. It's just not something that he can conceive of. The only character that understands that is the rational decision maker. And in the brains of procrastinators, I think if anything, it might just be a habit as much as anything else. They're in a very bad habit of letting the monkey win those battles, and they have very low self-confidence. The rational decision maker in their head has very low self-confidence that he can win that battle. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. He sees the monkey and he says, oh, here we go. I'm going to lose this again. And then he loses it again.
Can I just jump in here? Because this idea that like the monkey does not see the future self as him, I mean, there have been there's quite a bit of psychological research to support this, right? I mean, I'm looking at research here that finds that procrastination does seem to stem from a failure to actually identify with your future self, and that when you're setting goals, it's that future self that feels that goal is most relevant, but it's not the you who is in the here and now who needs to be doing the work.
Or I assign stuff to future Tim constantly. He's like my assistant. He does everything I ask him to. I always send him work. Everything I don't want to do, I just put on his list. And the only issue with him is that he doesn't exist. Every time I get to where he's supposed to be, he's not there. It's just stupid present Tim with his monkey back there again. And so it's this delusion that there's this future you that doesn't have the monkey, this future you that actually can act like an adult. And he's just going to do it. It's going to be great. I'm going to do this tomorrow. I'm going to do this later today after lunch. I'm going to do it. And you have this vision of that after lunch character as acting like an adult, when every piece of reality and history should tell you that that's not how that after lunch Tim is going to act. He's going to act the same exact way.
Yeah.
That you're acting right now.
You know, I read that you got when you started writing about this, you got so many responses from people. You're really touching a nerve here, and I'm wondering if maybe those folks should have been doing something else and meeting their goals other than writing to you. But yeah. Obviously, like there's really something to dig into here, and to that end, actually, we've got a ton of callers who want to join us, and I will no longer procrastinate in getting to these listeners. So let's go to Emily, who's calling from Nashville. You're on the air, Emily.
Hi, Meghna. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Hi. I am calling because this is a topic that I think about quite often. I work as a copywriter and a freelance writer, and I work in a really fast-paced agency environment, but I also write a lot of long-form, like, magazine pieces. And this is something I think about all the time because mentally I'm a super organized person, and I'm someone that really ticks things off and likes to get things done. But I can have a piece that's due like 3 months from now, and I'll sit down and maybe, you know, tinker with it here and there. And inevitably, I'm always up 4 hours before the deadline completing this piece. And one thing that I have found is that it actually, like, I can write something and spend that 3 months writing it, but then I'll look at it the night before it's due, and it's total crap because I've overthought it so much.
Right.
And so I'll sit down 5 hours before, and it's that, like, that adrenaline kicking in, and it's kind of like your previous caller. I find that it's a function of my job that I almost, like, I have to let go of that, in those inhibitions and that overthinking aspect of my brain to actually sit down and compose something that's, like, good.
Right. Emily, thank you so much for your call. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Andrew Santella, jump back in here. I mean, how much of what you heard Emily says reflects sort of the research that you uncovered in your book?
Yeah, one of the researchers I talked to just calls what she was referring to, he calls it arousal procrastination, which it's not as, you know, exciting as it sounds maybe, but it's procrastinators who get off on that on that excitement of rushing at the last minute. And some people will claim that, you know, I do better under pressure. I need the deadline pressure to really perform. Although I think some of the psychologists who study the topic would dispute that, whether there is such a thing as deadline pressure helping your performance.
Tim Urban, do you think that there is or isn't such a thing?
Well, I actually have a name for deadline pressure, and I call it the panic monster, which is a third character in your brain. And he's critical for the procrastinator because he's the only thing that the monkey's scared of. The monkey's terrified of the panic monster. So when the panic gets strong, the monster wakes up, freaks out, the monkey runs out of the room, and that's when I at least get anything done. And suddenly I get a lot done because the monkey's not there just for a brief moment. So I think that what the caller is talking about is she's her perfectionism is kicking in, which is another form of procrastination. She can't make that progress because the monkey is bothering. The monkey's holding the wheel, and then it's that the deadline hits, the panic monster rushes in the room, and suddenly, magically, this person has a different kind of work ethic suddenly and can get it done and can be an adult about it, which sometimes means not being a perfectionist and saying, look, we just got to make this thing happen. So for me, that's the third character. And, you know, to really get over your procrastination, you know, you can't just get things done with the panic monster. Getting over your procrastination really means that you can get things done without the panic monster there. And that is something I don't really know how to do.
Yeah.
I'm hoping you guys can help me.
Andrew, can you help?
Well, I'm not sure if I could. I'm given the monkey and the monster. It sounds like a big job. I'm afraid of both of those characters.
There's a lot going on.
But Tim, you must lead an exciting life. I recognize what Tim's talking about, though. I mean, we all the idea of the divided self is, you know, really a basic idea in our world, and we're all ambivalent. And I think a lot of procrastination grows out of that, you know, our native ambivalence and anxiety and our uncertainty about what should matter to us, what we should be doing at any given moment. So it's not just sort of the external, our inability to manage sort of the external stuff, the deadlines and the time pressures and the distractions, all that sort of thing. It's also our inner moods and our inability to regulate our moods and our anxieties and our ambivalence that leads to procrastination. And I think the way to get around to Tim's question, I mean, the only thing one can do is to try to understand as best one can, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I afraid of this project? Why am I reluctant to take this on? Try to get to the heart of it and understand why you're doing it.
Well, I want to
do you think we're so bad at this because we evolved to be in a tribe where we didn't have to really plan that long term, and you could basically, you know, the monkey, the instant gratification monkey, could kind of run your life and it was fine. You could relax and take it easy, and then when you got hungry or when someone, you know, an enemy was running at you, the panic monster would kick in and you would do what you needed to do. But that it's almost this new skill we need to kind of plan ahead, and we're not really good at it because we're not really optimized evolutionarily.
You know, Tim, I'm going to question early man, your vision of early man sort of twisting daisy stems waiting until they get hungry. But we'll pick this up when we come back. We're talking about procrastination, why we do it, what it means, and maybe how to overcome it. I'm joined by Andrew Santella and Tim Urban. We'll get a lot more callers when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
So you just woke up and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Hear Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about procrastination, why we do it, why we hate that we do it, or maybe that there are good reasons. And could it actually be buying us time to perform even better or meet our goals in a better way than we thought possible? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined today by Andrew Santella. His new book is Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. Also joining us is Tim Urban. His 2016 TED Talk called Inside the Mind of a Master Procrastinator was one of the most viewed talks of the year. Now, gentlemen, this conversation seems to be really hitting a nerve here because we got lots of comments. Tanya Keller sent us this tweet. Tanya writes, one of my favorite professors used to say, procrastinators are the true optimists in life. Agreed. Rex, in effect, sent us a comment on our website writing, procrastination seems similar to turning off your focus and spacing out so that the subconscious mind can figure things out, like one of those shower moments, getting an idea, or while on a walk or going to sleep. But in this case, it may be backwards. Andrew, I mean, does that make sense? Because I always thought that spacing out was actually kind of different than procrastination.
I was taken with the idea of the procrastinator as optimist, which very much resonates with me. I think, you know, I'm very much confident that tomorrow is going to be a better day to get something done. I lose hope in humanity at some time in the afternoon every day, and I lose all faith in myself. But I always feel like tomorrow is going to be better. And I think in that sense, any procrastinator is an optimist. Mm.
Well, let's get a bunch of calls here. Jim is calling from Bradenton, Florida. You're on the air, Jim.
Hi, Magna.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, I just wanted to say I love that y'all use 07 for your music. It's awesome. But I wanted to say that I have schizoaffective disorder, and I suffered from procrastination for a long time. And in treating my illness, I realized you all were talking about the executive function of the brain earlier. Schizoaffective disorder is basically the disruption of the executive function of the brain. And one thing I realized in recovery is that procrastination for me was had a lot to do with not managing my expectations uh-huh. and not being able to say no.
Huh.
So those were two big things for me, is learning how to say no and learning how to manage my expectations.
Oh, interesting. Jim, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate your perspective here. Let's go to Justin, who's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Justin.
Hi. How's it going?
Hi, Justin.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Sorry, I got a little bit of spotty service here. Yes, I would like to say that I'm a professional procrastinator. I have been for 24 years, and I am 24 years old. I'm on my way to work right now. I have to be there by 10, and I think that might tell you a little bit of an idea.
What are you doing on the phone with us?
Well, I pulled over to the side.
Okay.
Real quick.
All right, good.
Comment.
So, I mean, so it has being a lifelong procrastinator served you well, Justin?
Well, I have found similar examples of what the prior callers have explained, where there's this sudden jolt of get it done. You have to get it done, whatever it is, and then you get it done.
Yeah.
So I have found that similar kind of example.
Justin, thank you so much for your call. And yes, definitely time to get it done. Get to work. Mycroft is calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. You're on the air, Mycroft.
Hi, Magna. I'm a high school student, teenager, which is ideal time for a procrastinator. And my parents actually use Tim's TED Talk to tell me that I'm not doing my work. And I find that a lot of times I use procrastination because I'm not that motivated to do what I need to do, like my homework.
Yeah.
Which is actually what I'm not doing right now.
All these people putting off what they need to do to call this show. I appreciate that you're listening, and I love your perspective, Mycroft. But look, I'm a parent. It's time for you to get to your homework. Thank you so much for your call, Tim Urban. So Mycroft's parents said, hey, watch this video. It'll help you sort of grapple with, you know, with the distaste of doing homework. But he gets this idea of motivation. Now, how this seems central to all of this. If we can find ways to motivate ourselves rather than thinking that we simply can't do things or can put it off, wouldn't that make all the difference in the world?
Well, I think there's just different layers here, because I think a lot of the people who procrastinate, they actually procrastinate on the things that they're most motivated to do in a very macro sense. So the things they care about the most. Mm-hmm. You know, the caller earlier, you know, procrastinates on her on kind of her work output, which probably matters a lot to her. I think the more pride you take in something, the more you desperately want to achieve it and do well at it, the more you might actually find yourself procrastinating, because that motivation in the macro sense, it doesn't translate down to that moment. So you maybe you're motivated in 2018 or on Tuesday, but at 12:35 and 36 seconds on Tuesday, that motivation isn't translating down to that micro moment. In that micro moment, the monkey says, well, sure, of course, we're all motivated for this. We're going to do it. We're just going to do it in a little bit. We're just going to do this thing, because the monkey knows that you're a simpleton. And the monkey knows that if it can just get you to just push it off this moment, in this moment, it can just – the monkey can get you to kind of push it off again and again and again until it just doesn't happen. So you fall for it again and again. You think, okay, I'll just do this a little bit, and you're just – this kind of delusional optimism that you think, well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it later. The procrastinator always thinks that they're about to do it, that they're going to do it later today, that they're going to do it tomorrow. And I think it's actually a problem of a very kind of micro in the second motivation.
So, Andrew Santel, let me turn this to you, because about this, what Tim said about motivation, and perhaps like it's the things we're most motivated to want to do well that we may procrastinate on. I mean, we got a couple of comments here online. Jane Don't says she's curious about how perfectionism relates to procrastination. And Rachel Scott wrote in, I've been derailed by my procrastination my entire life. It cripples me with horrible anxiety every time I have a pending deadline. The only theory she has correlates to perfectionism.
I think Tim is exactly right when he says that we put off the things that matter most to us. And I think it suggests that, you know, that because these things mean so much to us, we feel, you know, most vulnerable and most at risk in regard to those things. The fear of failure is most acute, and for that matter, the fear of success. So I think it's exactly right that the things that matter the most and that should be our highest priority are the things that are often most natural for us to put off.
Yeah. We're talking about procrastination and why we do it. You've been hearing Andrew Santella and Tim Urban. So I would love to hear from you more folks out there about if you're a procrastinator or not. Megan is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Megan.
Hello, Tim, Andrew, and Magna. I'm interested in the topic of procrastination, and similar to your last caller, not even going to work at all today. And my point is that I am a terrible procrastinator. To Tim's point, I think that the panic monster is a lot more present in my life. So I'm always trying to check things off my to-do list, and that monkey very rarely gets a chance. But when he does, I'd say my biggest activities are exercise. So I'll go for a run, or I'll do some sort of like yoga to kind of fill my time. And I was wondering if Andrew had any thoughts in his book on activities for procrastination.
Wait, Megan, so I'm a little confused though. You say you're a procrastinator, but because of panic, like you're not a procrastinator?
Oh, I'm not a procrastinator at all. So I'm interested in this topic. I just don't really understand putting off the items that are important.
Yeah. So Megan, I actually thank you so much for your call, because I've been holding off, gentlemen, on on talking about this aspect of this issue, because I don't know, maybe it's my life. Maybe it's because I spend 10 hours a day literally staring at a clock whose seconds are ticking down, that I can't fathom like putting things off. And I think Megan's hitting on something here, that lots of us just have lives that aren't structured that to allow putting things off. And it just, I don't know whether it's panic or whatnot. And this whole idea of procrastination just seems a little kind of tough to wrap your head around. I mean, Andrew and Tim, your thoughts?
Well, I like to think of the everything you could spend your time doing kind of, you know, based on what a tool called the Eisenhower Matrix. So you can think about how urgent something is and how important something is, right? So if something can be urgent and important, or urgent and not important, and so on. And the thing that I think we need to distinguish here is urgent things, which the panic monster takes care of, you know, whether you're a procrastinator or not. The procrastinators might, you know, pull an all-nighter doing it, but they're going to get it done. Everyone's going to get those things done. And then there's the other quadrant there, which is the not urgent but important things. And that's where I think you have a lot of kind of undercover procrastinators, people who get their day-to-day stuff done. They hand their deadlines, you know, they get things in by their deadline, and they run their errands and they get their bills in on time. But when it comes to kind of maybe quitting their job or, you know, working on their relationship, working on their health, trying to start a business, things that are really hard and really kind of abstract, those things fall into that quadrant that is not urgent but important. And I think that a lot of people who kind of think, I don't understand procrastinators, way more people than you'll find, you know, the obvious chronic procrastinators are kind of long-term procrastinators. So I wonder if the caller and you and other people who don't have a kind of a short-term procrastination problem still actually are dealing with this problem in a much longer term, more abstract way.
Well, then if it's so long term, then perhaps it stops becoming an issue if I'm procrastinating over a period of years or decades. But Andrew, go ahead, jump in here.
Yeah, you know, I too have used the Eisenhower Matrix, although I found that when I tried to sort of prioritize my to-do list, and what I ended up doing was just sort of spending an awful lot of time just shuffling those tasks around to the various quadrants of the matrix. I could spend entire weeks doing that and never getting it was actually a satisfying activity. It helped me put off what I was supposed to be doing. So the matrix didn't really work that well for me, but it might for others.
Yeah. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Let's go to Stina, who's calling from Waterford, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a point that maybe was already made because I wasn't able to hear the whole show. I believe that procrastination can be, at least when it comes to writing, which is was very much a part of my professional life, very much a part of my educational life, that it can be a part of the creative process. So I would research and research and research and get way too close to deadline to be comfortable. And then I would go off and clean the house or something. And I was lamenting this with a friend of mine who said, no. You are still working on what you're working on while you think you're cleaning the house. Your brain in the background is putting it together. And at some point, you're going to come up with the sentence, the hook, the way to begin. It may not end up that with that sentence, but it gets you into the process. And she was absolutely right. I let go of that guilt. It doesn't mean that I didn't procrastinate and research right up until too close to deadline.
Uh-huh.
But it really worked.
Stina, thank you so much for your call. Andrew Santella, I think we're kind of almost coming full circle here, right? Because Stina reminds me where we started with Darwin, how doing other things actually sort of creates time and space for your brain for the creativity to happen. But your thoughts?
Well, I too have used that that idea that even though it doesn't appear that I'm working, I'm always working. I tell my wife that all the time. It looks like I'm laying on the couch, but I'm really writing. But writers, I think, you know, claim that it's the only occupation that lets itself get away with this idea that, you know, I need to be inspired, I need to feel in the mood, I need to get and that so much procrastination is about waiting for the perfect mood. And there is no perfect mood.
Yeah.
But and yet writers talk about, oh, can you imagine your car mechanic saying, well, I'll get to this oil change, but I need to take a walk on the beach first and wait for inspiration. It just doesn't work for any other discipline but writers.
Hmm. Well, let me just bring in a completely different perspective here about what procrastination may or may not be. This is a little clip of tape here. It's the hip-hop preacher Eric Thomas on a Motivation Monday segment of the Steve Harvey Show from January of 2016. And Thomas was answering a question about that came from a college student about procrastination.
I don't believe in the word procrastination. Like, I don't really believe in that word. I told a young lady in Australia who told me she was a procrastinator. Mm-hmm. I said, look, if I told you to meet me here tomorrow at 5 a.m. and I'm going to give you $3 million, where would you be? She said, I'm going to be right there at 4:59, ready to get that $3 million. And I said, so then there's no such thing as procrastination. What it is it's not important to you.
Tim Urban, what do you think of that?
Well, I think, again, he's talking about, yeah, the panic monster works. That doesn't mean that this isn't a problem. So, yeah, we'd all have the panic monster if we were going to have $5 million were at stake. What I think is you could say the same thing if I paid $5 million to someone who's struggling with their weight and they can't lose weight. They can't stop eating the things they know they shouldn't eat. Yeah, if I paid them $5 million to eat healthy for the day, sure, of course they could do it. That doesn't mean they don't have a problem. They have a problem because when there's not $5 million, when there's not an external kind of pressure going on, they're having this executive function battle in their head and they're losing. And I think procrastination and obesity and lots of these problems we have are actually the same problem. They're just different manifestations of it. It's this primitive part of us battling against the rational kind of advanced part of us, and it's losing that battle.
Yeah.
And so, I don't think that offering someone money to fix it for a day, it doesn't mean that they're incapable. It means that they're in the bad habit of losing that battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Andrew Santella, we've just got 30 seconds here left to go. I'm not procrastinating. We really do have 30 seconds left to go. But I imagine there's some people listening who maybe are looking to you for advice. What if they actually want to procrastinate a little less?
I'd say that if they think about what they're why they're procrastinating and what's important to them, as the speaker said, they'll start to come to terms with their own values, with their own priorities, and they'll start to understand maybe why they can do one thing and not another.
Yeah.
And if there's any value to procrastination, it's that it prods us to be a little more aware of what matters to us.
Well, Andrew Santella's new book is called Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination, from Leonardo and Darwin to You and Me. Andrew, thank you so much for this great hour. Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And Tim Urban, the author behind the hugely popular blog Wait But Why. It was great to talk to you as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magna.
Listener Leslie Coleman gets the last shot at it today. She says it isn't procrastination. It's called skilled crisis management. That is the end of this hour. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.